Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time. And if you'd like to be a part of the program, you can be a part of it during the live broadcast, which is, as I say, between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. Now, you might be listening at a different time of the day. You might be listening late at night because some of these programs are rebroadcast on some stations. And if that is true, of course, you can't call in the middle of the night because I'm asleep. But if you're listening in the afternoon, you're hearing me as I'm talking and as all other listeners who are listening live are. And when you want to give me a call, I'll be glad to take your call and entertain any questions you might have about the Bible. Notice I said I'll entertain them. I didn't say I'll answer them. And I don't know if I'm really that entertaining, but the truth of the matter is I don't promise to answer your questions. I only promise to discuss them. But I might know the answer. If I do, I'll help. If I don't, then someone else can help. And that's another thing here. If you feel like you've heard the wrong answer given by this host on this program to somebody else's question, if you disagree with something, some position taken here, feel free to call and to disagree here on the air. We have no problems with you doing that. In fact, I encourage you to do that. Perhaps one of the distinctives of this program is that you are as welcome to call if you disagree with the host as if you agree, perhaps even more so. So here's the number to call if you'd like to be on the program. We have a line open for you right now at 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090 if you want to be on the program. Our first caller today is Mike calling from Portland, Oregon. Mike, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. I first want to call just to say thank you. Personally, I've been listening to a lot of your topical lectures and verse-by-verse teaching on creation and eschatology and various others, and I just find them really edifying, and I really appreciate the time that you've put into there and the ability to for others to get it for free and still sit there in God's Word and actually learn something. So thanks for
thank
that.
Thank you. That's very gratifying. Thank you.
Yeah. I would say that I don't really normally believe in very many people. I'm very skeptical, but I tend to agree with you on most things, so I won't be calling in to argue about anything. I do have a question. I just finished listening to the Creation versus Evolution topical lecture, and I was downtown witnessing a few weeks back, and I talked to a lot of different atheists and people that believe in evolution, and one of the arguments I used was irreducible complexity. And I don't feel like I use a bacterial flagellum as an example.
Uh-huh.
I don't feel
from,
like I really
from Michael Behe's book, yeah.
I don't feel like I did a very good job justifying it. So because I was kind of I hadn't really studied it for a while, so I was a bit rusty. And I thought later maybe if I got in that same situation, I'd be able to say, hey, just go check this out on the website. So I actually Googled irreducible complexity to see what if I suggested that, what they would come up with. And I tell you, the first 20 links or so were vehemently arguing against it, saying that it was an argument from ignorance, and they had all kinds of diagrams and pictures showing how things could actually happen and how it's all plausible. And so I felt like almost semi-defeated in a way because, there's so much opposition to it. Could you, like, shed some light on irreducible complexity or maybe give a way to explain it clearly or maybe some other examples?
Well, sure. You know, traditional Darwinists are very angry at Michael Behe, who wrote Darwin's Black Box, and he's written subsequently also on intelligent design. Michael Behe, by the way, is not a biblical literalist. He's a Roman Catholic, and he's not really arguing for a young Earth creation or anything like that. But he is arguing that there are certain things in the, especially the microscopic world, which is his specialty. He's a microbiologist, which he said they defy explanation as to how they could have come about by small steps. You see, Darwin said if there was any structure in any organism that could be demonstrated to be impossible to produce by small steps, then he says my theory falls apart completely. And so it's essential to Darwinism to believe that a mechanism like the eye or like the flagellum on a bacterium or almost the wing of a bird or something like that that these structures had to develop slowly, because you just can't have a lizard laying an egg and a bird hatching out. You've got to have in evolution just small changes that would probably not even be noticeable generation by generation. And over hundreds of accumulated generations of these changes, then you finally have something new. But what Michael Behe is saying is there are actually things which have to be fully functional. They require several moving parts that work together. And you couldn't put it together a little bit at a time. You have to have the whole mechanism, or else it would have confer no benefit to the organism. And it's, one of the foundational ideas of natural selection is that those mutations and structures that don't confer any benefit to the organism, well, they're limited by natural selection. Only those things that are beneficial really make the grade. So, in other words, suppose you had a creature that didn't have a flagellum. And for those who don't know, a flagellum is just a little whip-like tail that some bacteria have, to kind of like a little propeller that shoots them around in their environment to get places. Now, it's like a little simple motor. It may not even be that simple, but it is at least a motor. And it has certain parts that make it move, just like a motor does. And you've got to have all those parts, or else you've got nothing at all. I mean, if a bacterium that didn't have a flagellum had a mutation which left it with a part of that apparatus, but not the complete apparatus, well, that part would be of no use to the thing, and therefore the next generation or two would weed that out of through natural selection. And you wouldn't have then hundreds of generations adding a little bit of advantage to each previous one, because the previous one would be no advantage at all and therefore would be eliminated. The same thing is true of the eye. Richard Dawkins has tried to deal with the eye issue in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, and he also dealt with a number of other things like this. But to my mind, he didn't provide any evidence at all. What he came up with was what he considered to be plausible explanations. But, you know, if you're committed to something wholeheartedly, then you'll find some things plausible that a more open-minded person wouldn't find plausible. I mean, for example, take you and me and our presuppositions. You're a Christian, I'm a Christian. We believe that a virgin became pregnant, and that Jesus was the result. We believe that a man rose from the dead. We believe, that many supernatural things happen. Well, these don't seem at all plausible to people who don't believe in God, but we are so committed to our belief in God that these things don't seem implausible to us at all. But to an evolutionist, evolution doesn't seem implausible. And you could name almost anything that an open-minded person would say, hey, wait a minute, that could never happen. And the evolutionist said, well, I can think of a way that it could, Now, to be able to think of a way that it could happen doesn't mean you have described what did happen. And, you can think of all kinds of strange accidents that could occur to make certain events take place. But that once you've concocted these possibilities, you haven't explained how the thing did take place. You've only imagined something. It may have happened that way or may not have. And that's the problem evolution has had. Now, frankly, what Michael Behe introduced was the concept. He didn't introduce it, and he just capitalized on it in his book, the Darwin's Black Box. The idea of irreducible complexity. He's saying, okay, once you've got a certain amount of an organism functioning, there are some developments, of course, improvements that can be made through mutation. It's not impossible to imagine that some things can get better. In fact, they do. We don't have any problem believing that a bacterium can develop, for example, an immunity to antibiotics. Now, of course, that's an improvement. That's a mutation. That's an improvement for it. But that bacterium already is a highly complex organism. The question is, how does something that is not a highly complex organism, that's just a soup of organic chemicals, how does that organize itself into protein molecules? And then how do those protein molecules organize themselves into a cell? Now, most people don't realize how complex even one protein molecule is, or the fact that protein molecules are not known from science to ever organize themselves out of organic soup. These things have never been observed. To the evolutionist, it doesn't seem implausible because they're committed to evolution. Anything is plausible. If evolution had to happen, then those things necessary to make it happen must have happened, no matter how implausible they seem. But to those of us who say, well, wait a minute, we're not so sure that evolution happened, not at least in the way you're talking about, as the origin of species, well, those, you know, we have every right to say, well, you know, you may find this plausible, but I'm reasonable. And I say it doesn't seem plausible at all. I say you're going to have to come up with something better than that. And, you know, the explanations of how the eye developed, actually Darwin himself, he said consideration of the eye from the standpoint of his evolutionary theory, he said it made him shudder, because he realized that it was truly a challenge to the idea that something could develop a little at a time. Some things are irreducibly complex. That is to say, some structures that exist are so complex that you can't reduce them into small steps to get from their absence to their presence. Now, yeah. I realize that if you do Google irreducible complexity, you're going to get a whole bunch of venomous, vehement evolutionists attacking Michael Behe's thing, because, frankly, he threatens them. He threatens them. You know, and it's interesting how terrified and hostile they seem to be. Because really what he's doing is threatening their religion. And their religion is not like ours, a religion of love. Their religion is a religion of naturalism and survival of the fittest. So to them, they just have to show their theory is the fittest theory. And frankly, I'm not impressed with them. Now, obviously, people who are evolutionists are going to be more impressed with their theories than I am. But I consider that we have every right to be open-minded and to question implausible, what seem to us implausible suggestions. And I think that all the suggestions of how, for example, how an eye developed, I keep mentioning that because Darwin saw it as a nemesis to his theory. Dawkins said that he can imagine a simple creature having a light-sensitive spot that eventually develops into a more complex visual apparatus, and how that a light-sensitive spot might confer some advantage on the creature over its contemporaries that don't have it, so that it would be retained and developed further on. And he said he can imagine how having, 50% sight might be better than having no sight. But what he's not pointing out is that having 50% of an eye isn't the same thing as having 50% of sight. You can have 90% of an eye and have zero sight. You know, you need a whole eyeball to have any sight at all. Of course, a light-sensitive spot is one thing, but no one has ever tried to trace a direct line of evolution from a light-sensitive spot on a bacterium to an eyeball in a multicellular creature.
Well, they did do it on the website. They actually took them, like they took a light-sensitive spot, and then they drew multiple pictures, you know, showing it evolve basically into an octopus eyeball or something like that. They had a lot of different diagrams and stuff, which really, I used to be believing in Darwinistic stuff.
Uh-huh.
I was raised in a school that taught it, and I blindly believed my teachers and my textbooks. After I got saved, I got new perspective. So I can understand being on one side of it and being really closed-minded and dogmatic.
Sure.
Even if you don't have all the facts. But they have stuff that seems convincing if you don't really dig into it and you don't have that.
They have arguments. They have arguments, but arguments are not the same thing as evidence.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they point out to us. You know, we don't have any proof of creation either, nor do we claim to. We don't claim to. We have arguments. And I guess a person's biases are going to have to tell them whether the arguments for one sound more plausible than the arguments for the other. I mean, the wing of a bird is another example that is often used, because it is believed by evolutionists that the wings of birds evolved from the front leg of a reptile, like a lizard. Well, if that happened gradually, then what we have, of course, we're going to have some millions of years this taking place, and sometime in the middle of that time, you're going to have a lizard that's gradually losing the use of his forearm as a leg, because it's not going to be so much a leg anymore as it's going to be more of a wing. And so he's not going to be so fit for survival. He won't have a complete wing that he can fly with, but he won't have a complete leg anymore that he can run or climb with. So, I mean, you've got to take that creature through transitional forms that are not really superior in terms of viability to his predecessors. But evolutionists believe this happened anyway. And, you know, to me, evolution is the creation myth of atheism. They believe that Genesis 1 is the creation myth of Judeo-Christianity. of course, ancient pagan religions all had their creation myths, or at least many of them did. Evolution is the creation myth of atheism. And they don't have any more proof of it than we have for anything else. They have arguments. They have what they consider to be plausible suggestions. They have their own interpretations of data. But no one has ever provided any evidence that the first living thing arose from non-living things. What they can do, possibly, in some cases, they haven't really done this quite yet, but they've come close in some cases, is they can work very hard to try to come up with something like the beginning of a living thing in a laboratory by a scientist intelligently putting the right chemicals together in conditions they hope might have existed. But there's a couple things we have to remember. Even if they successfully create life in a test tube someday, it will not prove that that ever happened in nature. That is to say, it'll prove that it can be done. It won't prove that it ever did happen in nature. It only gives us an example of something that can happen. But the second thing is it'll prove to us that it takes high amount of intelligence to create life, because the scientists are intelligent, presumably, and it took their intervention to make it happen. We, no matter how much evidence they have that will make evolution a plausible explanation, there is no evidence that it really happened. At least nothing that's compelling any more than there is evidence that creation happened. We're talking about here two philosophical systems related to two different religions. One is atheism and one is Christianity. It's a competition between religions, and the two will certainly see the data through the filter of their own religious pre-commitments.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the feather. I heard you say that on the lecture.
Yeah.
And, we homeschool our children.
Uh-huh.
And my wife that went to a homeschool convention to pick out some books, and she started praying, and she just stuck her hand out and touched this one book, and so she grabbed all the stuff on science from them. And it turned out to be these things from Answers in Genesis. And it's so awesome. It has stuff like that. It has diagrams of the picture of a feather, and it has a hook system.
Yeah, the hook and eye system. It's like Velcro. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have really good study stuff for our kids that has, a lot of the same basic things. So,
well, Mike, my lines are falling. I have to move along, but I wish you well there. Obviously, there are a lot. If you go online, you'll find a lot more information on this than I can give you in this format. And certainly, you'll find it from people who are more qualified than I am to speak about it, because I'm not specially trained in science. But there are people who are professional scientists who will give you the same information, only with more accuracy and more authority than I can.
All right. God bless. Thanks a lot.
God bless you, Mike. Good talking to you. Bye. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have one line open now. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. We're going to talk next to Robert, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Robert, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, and also, if you can point me in the right direction so I can research it myself, would be great. Since Adam and Eve committed the original sin, was there an out they had that the Lord provided so that they could be in heaven with us after the rapture? Like all of us that have lived through generations since past, who are going to one day get to be all of us, the past people from the Bible and whatnot, our heroes and...
Well, yeah, we may not be able to meet everybody from the past, because some of them may not be in heaven, you know. But Adam and Eve, whether they're in heaven or not, is, of course, one of those things that we're not specifically told in Scripture. On the one hand, the New Testament only speaks of Adam as a bad person. Adam is mentioned in Romans chapter 5 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And in both places, Adam is blamed for introducing sin and death into the world, and really nothing good is said about him because of his actions. So if we had only that to go on, we might get the impression that he was just a bad guy and we're probably not going to see him in heaven. On the other hand, we read in Genesis chapter 3 that after Adam and Eve sinned, God... excuse me, what's that background noise there?
It was my work radio going off. I turned it
okay.
down.
Okay, are you a taxi cab driver?
No, I do some
okay.
work.
Oh, okay. In Genesis 3, we are told that God killed animals and took the skins and used them to cover Adam and Eve's nakedness. And I think their nakedness is not only literal, but also symbolic of their guilt. And the killing of animals to get their skins to cover Adam and Eve's guilt or their nakedness, I believe, is the first blood sacrifice ever offered. And blood sacrifices generally were intended for covering sin. And God himself is the one who offered this particular sacrifice. He's, so there's some reason to believe that very possibly the sacrifice that was offered was showing God's intention to cover their sin and possibly to forgive them. I don't know for sure. We do know that later on in their lives, after the fall, the things they said, for example, what Eve said when her son Seth was born, indicated that she was seeing Yahweh, or the Lord, as the giver of children to her. So there was some piety still there. We know that some of their, well, Adam, I mean, excuse me, their first two sons, Cain and Abel, one of them at least was close to God. Whether he heard from God from his parents or directly just from God, we don't know. But I guess we don't have enough data to know exactly what state of mind or heart Adam and Eve were in at the time they died, because after the fall, they lived another 930 years. And
right.
So it may very well be that they were pious and died in faith.
Okay. I mean, I know the Lord wishes that no one have died.
That's right.
So I was just more or less a curiosity of where I could research it at, and I guess that, you know, Romans and was it Corinthians you said?
Well, Romans 5, beginning around verse 12.
Okay.
And 1 Corinthians 15, and I forget which verses that begins, and I don't have time to look
it
up.
I'll start reading Corinthians chapter 15 and keep going until I find what I'm looking for. I was looking for some information, and thank you very much for your input. I really appreciate it.
Good to hear from you, Robert. Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you.
God bless you. All right, our next caller is Harold with a question from Portland, Oregon. And we have one line open here now if you'd like to call, 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. If you'd like to call in, you have a question from the Bible or about Christianity, or you'd like to disagree with the host, feel free to do that. The number to call, 1-800-438-5090. Harold, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Good afternoon. I assume that as a matter of righteous indignation, if you were walking down a street and saw a very brutal man beginning to assault a little girl, you would feel that it was incumbent upon you to intervene, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And yet, that circumstance happens every day, and God chooses not to intervene. I'm given to think, then, that there must be something from the divine perspective wherein you would have to say it was better for God not to intervene than to intervene. Am I okay so far?
I think that's very possibly true. I would just say God is, of course, not obligated to intervene, but you're right. I think his perspective sees more of the outcome long-term than we do, including the eternal outcome, and therefore his decisions might, well, certainly would be informed more than ours would be about what to do in each case.
Okay. Now, that's okay because we can't point to Scripture and verse, or at least I can't, and say God is obligated to intervene, and here's the basis on which he's obligated to intervene.
Right.
What if and when, and it's extremely pertinent to the 41 people here listening to your voice, and I'm sure thousands of others, when there appears to be a scriptural promise which God does not fulfill, and therefore you begin a sinking into some sort of practical agnosticism or practical deism because he's not responding. Now, to further explain that, everyone that I previously mentioned has a diagnosis, any similar diagnosis to bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, which are just actually descriptions of behavior as opposed to a genuine diagnosis because they don't say what the problem is.
Sure.
The behavior is. You know, I've heard on your show before different individuals calling in and saying, well, a imbalance of certain chemicals in the brain, which isn't proven, by the way, and is now being really challenged.
You're right. I would challenge that.
If that were true, then we are saying in order to have the peace that passes understanding, you must also have Prozac, et cetera. But I'm sorry for chasing a rabbit, but here's the question. Of these people, all of which profess to have, in the best way they know how, trusted Christ and his vicarious atonement for the expiation of sin, and in every way they know how, trying to live a life that would in no way bring shame to his name and hopefully fulfill the 420, there are 420 places that I find that use the word peace in the Bible. Some of them have certain stipulations that if fulfilled should bring you peace. And yet in the lives of these people, day and night, life is torment. And the laying on of hands and praying to receive the Holy Ghost and the number of different things that self-appointed theologians present us with just bring more excruciating pain. And in many cases, specifically mine, there are times when purposeful sin is the only way to deal with it. If I have a vengeful thought, if I take a quick look at a picture I shouldn't look at, the torment from it at least might point to the fact that I'm not beyond hope. So wherein can we say the same thing as in the first hypothetical case, that for some reason God has chosen to put aside his own word and say, these people will not have peace, and there's a divine reason which they could not perceive that explains the whole thing, but they'll not know in this lifetime.
Well, I think I understand your frustration. Before I try to answer that, am I to understand that you're actually with a group of people right now who have bipolar disorder?
They are actually, well, not specifically bipolar. Some do, some just schizophrenia, various other diagnoses.
So you're actually in a room full of people who are listening to this right now?
They are listening to it over the radio. I'm in a room next to it. And we refer to ourselves, at least somewhat in jocularity, as the Bipolar Baptist Church or the Pentecostal Church, et cetera, but it's anything but funny.
I know. Well, first of all, I want to say this. Whatever I may say, I'm not insensitive to the problem. I have some relatives through marriage that have been greatly tormented and have been diagnosed as being bipolar, although they are at least professing Christians themselves. And so this has been a great frustration and perplexity to those of us who love them. And I've obviously had to think about this myself a great deal. It is true that there's no actual proof that bipolar disorder is caused by a chemical imbalance. There may be something physiological that's behind it. It's hard to say because it's a mysterious thing. It's a behavioral thing. And it's not like diabetes that you can tell somebody has it by taking a blood sample or something. It's you just look at their behavior and you interpret it that way, and that's what psychiatric diagnoses are. They're really some specialist making an estimation and giving an opinion about people's behavior. But certainly there are a lot of people who have this problem. They're tormented in their minds by these swings, and your question is how does that impact on the way we understand the promises of the Bible, to have the peace that passes understanding, or the fruit of the Spirit is peace, and so forth. And these are Christian people. Without claiming to be, an expert about such things, which I am by no means an expert on them, I can only give you the best answer that I have come up with. And there may be a better one forthcoming in the future. I believe that we have to understand that the promises of God are not fulfilled instantaneously, necessarily. Some of them are, some are not. I mean, the Bible does tell us that Jesus came to deliver us from all sin. But even after people become Christians, they still struggle with certain sinful patterns at times. I'm not referring to bipolar as sin. I'm simply saying this is a parallel argument, that there are things the Bible promises to people that they don't find to be true immediately when they become Christians. In fact, sometimes they have to wrestle for years with certain things, but the promise of God is in the context of a certain assumption that we don't always appreciate. And the assumption is that once we have come to Christ, we are now on a lifelong journey toward Christlikeness. And when we start out, there's many things in us that need to get fixed. Many sinful problems, perhaps maybe even some physical problems, certainly many habits of mind, perhaps some torments of mind, perhaps even some demonic afflictions in some cases, all kinds of things, all kinds of baggage that we have when we come to Christ. And he starts unloading the baggage. But see, we're so accustomed to instant cures. I mean, we want to go to the doctor and have him give us a pill that'll fix everything, or we just want everything to happen yesterday. We don't appreciate the fact that God is working in our character certain things, too. And I know some people will say, well, this is a cop-out, but frankly, I just think it's true. I think it's true that God is working in our character, and he allows us to have certain challenges that hang on. Some people, when they get saved, you know, they immediately lose their interest in cigarettes. Other people struggle for years to overcome their addiction to smoking. You know, same thing with drugs. I've known people who got saved and they were heroin addicts, and they came off their heroin without any kind of, withdrawal or anything like that. Now, other people have had to go through, you know, medical interventions and so forth. I don't know why God does things instantly for some people and not for others. I will say this, that when I was running a school in Oregon for 16 years, we had quite a few students who came who were under psychiatric treatment and who had received who were using meds, you know, for whatever, for schizophrenia, for bipolar disorder, for any number of things they were on meds for. And many of them, in the course of the school year, found themselves becoming free from those meds because of what God was doing in their life. But not all of them did. I'm not predicting that everyone's going to have the same experience. But I will say that some people, when they become Christians, their struggle is going to be against this kind of mental torment. I knew somebody, a Christian, who had nothing but bad dreams every night, tormenting dreams for a year and a half. And they kept praying, you know, and doing spiritual warfare, trying to overcome it. And eventually it just trailed off. And eventually they got a victory over it. But it was gradual and it took time. I guess the point I'm making is God's promises are not necessarily guaranteed to be fulfilled as soon as we ask them to be, as long as we ask for God to fulfill them. It's we who assume that we should get instant relief from things that are troubling us. God often realizes that our struggling against things for an extended period of time often is just what we need to develop the spiritual disciplines and the spiritual muscles that are going to hold us instead for even greater challenges down the way. And while I have never experienced the mental torment or challenges that a person with bipolar has, I've had other kinds of things. I've had problems with people. I've had physical problems at times. I mean, everyone has a different kind of testing. But the idea is that no matter what happens, God is teaching us to trust him in our trials. And there is a peace that passes understanding that Christians can know. But it's not always the first thing that happens. God may work on some other grace in a person's life. But, you know, when we're saying, God, I want you to remove this problem because it's interfering with my spirituality. Well, your very submission to God in the midst of it is your spirituality. Your very trust in God. Now, to a person who doesn't know God, which is not you, but someone who may be listening could be in this category, they may say, well, you Christians, you've just got a line to explain everything away. You know, obviously your religion isn't working for you, so you come up with a nice little explanation. Well, the truth is we do come up with explanations because life is to be explicable. And we do believe that Jesus is real, that God is real, that his promises are true. We've seen him work miracles and changes in people's lives. We've also seen him not work miracles and changes in some people's lives, including our own, at least not as quickly as we'd like to see them. But one thing that we Christians do stand by is that God is faithful and good. And if he has promised something, He intends to fulfill it. Now, one thing you pointed out, I think, and or I would have if you hadn't, is that a lot of promises are conditional. And even the promise, you know, of the peace that passes understanding shall keep your hearts and minds, that's a conditional promise. And, you know, it starts out with, you know, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. He also says, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are good, whatsoever things are true, think on these things. And that's in the same context. And after all that, he says, and the peace of God, which passes understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds. Which means, of course, there's certain things that we're told to do, and not just to do once, but to do as a habit. And the result will be, although we don't know how soon it will be, but the result that's promised is the peace of God. And I do believe that God does sort of stretch it out sometimes, hold it out, and delay things for the sake of testing our faith. And again, I realize to a skeptic, this is just another Christian cop-out. But frankly, it's not a cop-out. God does test our faith. God does want our faith to be strong. And he does. There's the trial of our faith being much more precious than of gold that perishes. She'll be found under glory and honor at the coming of Christ. So all I can say, I mean, it'd be nice if I had something to say that no one else said before. I mean, you've got a group of suffering people there. They're looking to God and in some measure to me right now to give them God's answer to their problem. And I have nothing new or original to say, but what I do have to say is still true, still valid. It's what Christianity has always taught and what many Christians have found to be true in their experience over the centuries. And something that just calls on us to be patient, to keep trusting God, to keep submitting to God. A lot of times that's not what we want to hear. It's like if a person's starting to have symptoms of diabetes and the doctor says, okay, well, here's what you got to do. You got to drink a lot of water. You got to lose some weight. You have to stop eating all sugar. You're going to go on this strict diet. Well, who wants to do that? I just want a solution now, you know. But a lot of times God's cures and God's answers come to us as a result of us adopting his patterns over a long period of time. And, boy, I'll tell you what, if I was tormented with bipolar disorder, I wouldn't want to be waiting a long period of time. I'm sympathetic toward that. Though there are many people who don't have that particular disorder, but they've got some physical, disease, or they've got a horrible marriage they're in and they're stuck in, or they're in some kind of poverty that they can't seem to get out of. You know, it seems like everybody's got something. Everybody's got something that's bothering them. And most of us say, well, I'd take that instead of what I got. You know, if God would just let me have their trials instead of the ones I got, I'd prefer it. And the truth is, we don't get the choice. Perhaps the one we would prefer is the one we can't have, because then it ceases to be such a trial. And the purpose of it is to be a trial and a test. So I sure wish I just had the magic wand or the magic pill that could just say, well, here's your solution. But my answer, my foundational answer would be, God is faithful. His promise is true, but he doesn't always answer immediately. And sometimes he simply requires us to keep a long obedience in the same direction before we see the results that are at the end of that path.
And sometimes, about 15 hands just went up here, and I'm going to be selfish and make a quick response if I could. You use words like immediately or in time. Now, I'm referred to as the epitome of bipolar disease, as they refer to it, and I've been told very bluntly that I am committing suicide here, that I am dying, and apparently that's true because of the physical problems that result from the constant anxiety and et cetera. But when we're using terms like immediately or the rate or time in which he does it, I am your age, given a year or two, and 35 years ago, if you and I were standing and looking at a tree, and I said it's dark green, you said it's light green, my overwhelming inward emotion would be to punch you for disagreeing with me on a minor issue like that, that kind of rage within. 35 years later, and being through multiple persons who come in and say, we just need to cast out the demons with no results, I've been to six Bible colleges, degrees, searching for answers from people who just result to different theological constructs that don't help. And today, if you and I were standing in front of the same tree and made the same comment 35 years later, still, my overwhelming desire would be to punch you. The inward rage would come out, and I would turn and walk away rather than do so. So it's not a matter of immediate. It's a matter
of victory,
long.
That's been 35 years, but that's a victory still you have. I mean, if you have an urge to do something, and let's say the average person wouldn't have that same urge, so to you it's a stronger temptation than it would be to somebody else, still, your victory is not in ceasing to have that urge. Your victory is in resisting that urge. You know, as you probably know, virtually all men, including Christian men, have visual temptations toward women. And some men, after 50 years of following Christ and fighting off the wrong temptations in that area, they still have temptations like that, you know, urges. Yeah. And
Three years old, I begin to have those, living in a Christian family, and I have them today.
Yeah.
As strong as that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I'm sorry.
Well, no, what I'm saying to you is, obviously, I'm not in your shoes, and I certainly pity those who are, like yourself, and the people who are with you there. And as I said, if I could give you a pill or a Bible verse that would change everything, I'd be eager to do so. But all I know, I mean, and this is not as helpful as I wish I could be, but all I know is that God requires the same thing of all of us, but he doesn't put the same burdens on all of us. Each person has different burdens, but everyone has burdens. I mean, mankind is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. It's just that different kinds of troubles attach to different people, and I'm not trying to, in any sense, minimize the kind of struggles that you and your companions there are facing. I'm only saying that they are struggles of a different sort than some other people have, that all people are going to have struggles, and God's expectation is that we fight the good fight until the day we die. But the day we die is the day we graduate from the test, and then he says, well done, good and faithful servant. And he knows better than I do, or anyone else does, just how hard that test was for you. He knows how long you've been struggling against that. And he knows the effort that you're putting into resisting those issues. And when you fall, he knows exactly how hard it would have been for you to stand. I mean, God is sympathetic toward you far more than anyone else could possibly be. But it's, to me, the Christian life is not the life of saying a few prayers or even saying prayers for a certain number of years and then suddenly it's smooth sailing from then on. I believe that the trials and the tests are a lifetime. And when we're done being tested, that's when we're done living. So you guys know better than I do exactly the nature of your test, but it sounds like it's extremely unpleasant, extremely severe. And I would simply say there are people in some situations who've been, you know, in prison and tortured, and that's their test, you know, for Christ. And it's just different. I realize some of us have it really easy compared to others. But the answer, I believe, is the same for all. And that is to trust Christ, to obey Christ, to look to him for strength to overcome the temptations, and to wait for him to secure a final victory, which may come in your lifetime or may not. I don't mean to be negative, but if it doesn't come in your lifetime, there is eternal rest and eternal peace that's offered to those who are faithful to the end, and that's what we're all called to do. Harold, I know, this is not a private counseling session here, obviously. We're on a public radio program, and I've got my lines full, and the issues you're raising are important enough to justify hours of interaction, but the format of the radio show is not going to allow me to go much longer with it. I would be very happy, though, to talk more with you, either off the air or for you to call back again, and we can continue this sometime.
Thank you for your kind attention. Bye-bye.
God bless you, Harold. I'm sure our prayers are with you. And I hope our listeners will remember the struggles some of these people are going through and do pray for them. Let's talk next to Clay, who's calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. We've got callers from Las Vegas coming in lately since we've started on KKVV there in the last few weeks. Clay, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm 60 years old now. And in 1963, I was raised on military bases mostly.
Yeah.
And it was I'd been in public school maybe 2 years, and my dad was transferred to Florida during the Cuban crisis. And that's the first evolution that I ever heard in school. And I got to be honest, we went to church on the base and that, but I had never, really studied. But I was a straight 100 in math and science, and that was my dream, and, doing something in science. And the teacher kept talking about us being from apes and that, and I asked him one question, and I went to a straight F student, and I had to transfer into another teacher's class. Am I still there?
Yeah, so you were persecuted for asking a question challenging evolution in school.
Well, all I asked is, I said, you know what, I'll give up everything I've heard growing up if you can just explain to me how 10,000 animals and amoebas and stuff on the food chain all evolutioned at once, because something has to eat something on the food chain. Did the whole food chain just pop up one day? And the guy went crazy. He said all I wanted to do was cause trouble in the class, and he kicked me out. And I've asked a couple of these guys that say we're from apes and amoebas, and I say, what, the whole food chain? And it, basically, they all do the same thing. They go crazy. They just say, you want to fight. You want to argue. You don't want to listen to reason.
Well, see, I'm sure there probably are some evolutionists who, if they had the time and the patience, could try to give what they would consider to be their version of an explanation of your challenge. But what you encountered, of course, is your typical science teacher who doesn't know much except what he's been told to say about this. I mean, the typical science teacher is not an expert about evolution or science. They've read books about it, and if you challenge them, no one told them how to answer those questions, and there are some people very much threatened by a student saying, you know, could you please explain that, because I'm not sure I'm buying it. Some teachers just expect people to believe them. To believe what they say, and I'm the teacher, you're the student, I've got the education, you don't, that's what you're here for, you're supposed to listen to me, and if you actually think in their class and raise a question, even if you're not really trying to challenge them, you're just wondering, a lot of times they feel greatly challenged because they're not at all prepared to answer. And by the way, science classrooms are not the only places you find that. Some preachers are that way.
I've talked to some people that are real hardcore atheists and evolutionists and saying we come from monkeys. And when I ask them the same question, they try to say this eats that. And I said, I just say, certain things eat certain things. And the food chain goes up. I mean, sure, all the little things will eat off of any dead body. But there is a food chain. And if the food chain got out of control, things would disappear.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think they
can't really answer that everything pops up in a mathematical equation that this will eat that now, and this will eat that, and this will eat that, and you know what I'm saying?
Well, I do, Clay, but I think if I were an evolutionist, I'd give you an answer something like this. I would say, okay. well, plants evolved before animals did for the most part. And the earliest animals to evolve ate the plants. Or, ate the algae or whatever that was there already. The algae didn't have to eat other creatures. The algae lived off of sunlight and, minerals and so forth in the water. And so the first animals began to eat this algae and these plants. And eventually, after certain numbers of species of animals had evolved, some of them were still herbivorous and still ate plants. Others of them developed digestive systems and teeth and so forth that caused them to prey on other herbivores, and so that eventually you know, it may start out with a few species of predators and a few species of prey, but eventually through the marvelous process of evolution, you know, hundreds of thousands of different species, both kinds, came along, but it was very gradual. But there was always some prey for the original predators, because there were animals that were herbivorous before there were predators. If I were an evolutionist, I would say that. Now, I'm not an evolutionist. I don't think evolution is the explanation of the origin of species, but I think that there would be some evolutionists who would feel competent to answer that. And some of them would probably answer it similarly to the way I did. But the main thing, of course, to me, the main evidence against evolution, and there are others, there are a number of evidences that make evolution seem implausible, but the one that makes it seem unhistorical, that is to say that it didn't really ever happen, at least not in the wholesale manner that evolutionists hope it did, is that the fossil record does not contain a record of that kind of progress. You don't have the kinds of intermediate forms in the fossil record that would have had to have lived and died if evolution had indeed happened in the way that they say. Now, by the way, it should be understood that nobody denies, at least no one should deny, that microevolution happens. And what I mean by that is that the species do adapt. They adapt to new environments.
Like disease does.
Right, exactly.
Like bacteria and that, yeah.
That is adaptation. And in a sense, that could be called evolution, but it's not at all what people are talking about when they talk about Darwinian evolution, because Darwinian evolution requires not that variations develop in the species, but actually that all species arose from previously existing species. And there's no evidence in the fossil record of that at all.
But doesn't when a bacteria or something changes because it gets resistance to something, it doesn't change its whole form. It changes its resistance.
Its chemistry and so forth, yeah.
What
they would point out is that some more complex creatures do experience mutations where they do have different, some changes. Like you find occasionally a two-headed sheep that's a mutant or a six-fingered man. And you do see new structures, but you don't see new kinds of structures. You see actually just a multiplication of existing structures. You know, the DNA got mixed up and made six instead of five fingers on the hand, or two heads instead of one, or it might be a Siamese twin that went wrong or something. But these are indeed mutations that are known to occur, but they do not necessarily represent an upward direction of improvement.
A whole new breed.
Exactly. You know, the music's playing. That means I'm out of time. But, Clay,
okay,
I appreciate
I'm
your
sorry.
Call. No, don't be sorry. You called because I wanted you to. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
God bless you. And my apologies to other callers who are waiting online and were not able to get on. But we are a daily program, so that means tomorrow, Lord willing, if we're still alive and doing what we're doing, you'll have another chance to visit us here at the Narrow Path. We're on daily from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. And if you're not a regular listener, well, that can change. You can become one, and you can call in whenever questions arise. The Narrow Path has been on the air daily for over 11 years on some of our stations, and we've just added some new stations recently. We're glad to have our listeners there. We remain on these stations because we pay for the time. We buy the time on the station. We have no sponsors. We have nothing for sale. We don't do anything to generate income except to tell you that we have bills to pay, and if you'd like to be among those who feel moved to help us pay them, you can. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you didn't get that, you can get it from our website. Many resources there, free to you, nothing for sale, but lots of good free stuff. The website, www.thenarrowpath.com. That's just like the name of the program, The Narrow Path. My name's Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.